This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Support for the world comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
Europeans bracing for higher energy bills this winter. Some there argue it's time to save electricity and cut back on holiday lighting.
If nobody is present in your living room, for example, there's no need to illuminate a Christmas tree.
A war on kilowatt consumption. Also on the show, an update on the rescue operation after Indonesia's deadly earthquake this week. A defiant Philharmonic in Kyiv, plus a look back at the war crimes trial of Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic and the American war crimes prosecutor who went digging for evidence.
These ethnic conflicts don't happen because the minute the lid is lifted, they go fighting at each other and it's just ancient tensions which boil over.
Instead, these conflicts are driven from the top and the prosecutor made that case. That's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for making it here this Friday. Today marks the unofficial start of the winter holiday season in the U.S. Lots of people string up lights on their houses pretty soon. Take care on the ladders, everyone. In Europe, the festive season has also begun. That usually means elaborate light displays on the streets, pop-up skating rinks, and Christmas markets. But with Russia's war in Ukraine sending energy bills sky high in Europe, this year some cities are adjusting their plans. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
The center of Madrid was jam-packed last night as thousands turned out to watch the Christmas lights being switched on. There was an impressive fireworks display too. The Spanish capital isn't doing anything by half measures this year. 20,000 lights are shining down on one giant 3D nativity scene. And 11 million LED bulbs are lighting up the city. Most locals out last night seemed pretty impressed.
Fantastico, estupendo.
El árbol precioso, maravilloso.
Me encanta.
Maravillosa, muy bonita.
Fantastic, marvelous, so pretty, they said. Madrid, like most European cities, is dealing with huge energy bills right now. But the city's mayor has refused to cut back on the extravagant light display this year, saying it would be bad for business. Other cities are doing things differently, though. In Paris last Sunday, Mayor Anne Hidalgo pressed a giant button, switching on the fairy lights lining the Champs-Élysées.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
But this year, those lights will be turned off 2 hours earlier than usual every night. And the Eiffel Tower, which normally sparkles until 1 a.m, is going dark before midnight. It's all part of what the French government calls its sobriety measures, aimed at cutting down on energy usage. Not all French people are convinced, though.
Je pense que c'est un peu, enfin c'est bien pour le symbole. Je pense que c'est un peu du greenwashing, vite fait.
Student Alexis Marc on the Champs-Élysées told the AFP news agency, while the move is symbolic, it feels a little like greenwashing to him. In Germany, land of the much-loved Christmas markets, stallholders are being told to use fewer lights and invest in more LED bulbs. The western German town of Bad Neuenahr has replaced its traditional ice skating rink, which requires lots of energy to keep it frozen, with a roller skating park. Electricity prices there are up 26%. One German environmental group is calling on households to make changes too.
So my proposal was to concentrate to a Christmas tree or even to a branch, but not to illuminate the houses itself from the outside or even the gardens.
Jürgen Resch is CEO of Deutsche Umfeldhilfe.
If nobody is present in your living room, for example, there's no need to illuminate a Christmas tree.
Resch says he's happy to see so many German businesses reducing their energy usage this year, and he has little respect for the decision by Madrid's mayor to make no changes whatsoever.
I think this is stupid. In Germany, Christmas markets are very important for tourism. And if it's possible in Nuremberg, in Munich, to reduce illumination and to have the same amount or even more visitors, it's a proof that climate protection and Christmas feeling and retail success can fit together.
On London's busiest shopping street, Oxford Street, the Christmas lights have been on since the start of November. But Dee Corsi, CEO of New West End Company, which manages the shopping district, says the lighting hours have been reduced.
You can see they've just come on at 3 o'clock today and they'll go off at 11 p.m. tonight. Before they would have been on 24 hours a day, so this year they're only on for the 8 hours.
Copenhagen, Lisbon and Vienna are all pulling the plug on some of their Christmas lighting displays too. In one European city though, there'll be no Christmas lights this year. Kyiv authorities have banned any holiday lighting on the streets of the Ukrainian capital. The region's governor said the city needs to do all it can now to save the limited energy it has. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Meanwhile, in Ukraine, the energy shortages are happening right now and they're dire. Millions of people there are still without heat or power after Russia launched more devastating airstrikes on Ukraine's energy grid this week. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the situation in a video released overnight. Zelensky said that the electricity situation remains difficult in almost all regions of the country, but that they are moving away from the blackout little by little, with power being restored to more people every hour. A video on Twitter shows the excitement for some people in Kyiv as the lights came back on. The video shows apartment buildings with only a handful of lights turned on inside. Otherwise, it's nighttime, pitch black outside. You can hear residents in the buildings rejoicing and yelling out their windows, "Glory to Ukraine!" That determination was also on display at the National Philharmonic of Ukraine. Yesterday, the prestigious orchestra, the Kyiv Soloists, took to the stage in Ukraine's capital. Two discrete overhead lights lit up the artists. Tinier ones illuminated their sheet music. Other than that, the concert hall was dark. At the end of the performance, singers belted out, "There is Ukraine, there will be Ukraine." Zelensky also spoke about this united front in his video address last night. He said, "We endured 9 months of full-scale war, and Russia has not found a way to break us," and added, "They will not find it." In Indonesia, rescuers are continuing to look for survivors and bodies after Monday's earthquake. More than 310 people were killed, including many children. The quake triggered landslides which buried entire villages. Meanwhile, monsoon rains and aftershocks are complicating rescue efforts. Reporter Wahyu Datmika is in Indonesia, in Jakarta. He works for Tempo Media Group, an independent news organization based in Jakarta. First of all, Wahyu, describe the devastation in some of these hardest hit areas.
Yes, we have a team of reporters on the ground, Marco, since day one, and we've seen a lot of difficulties to reach and send the logistics needed by the refugees. And the rains really make the health condition of these refugees worse. And although I think the Indonesian army has sent more than 6,000 soldiers, a lot of roads are reported to be broken. It's very difficult to move cars or trucks to get to the area. So they have to rely on motorcycles to get the foods and blankets, the dry clothes to the refugee camps.
What does that mean for how people are surviving if a lot of these rescue efforts are unable to reach ground zero?
It can be very worrying. It's high on the government's priority now to make sure that they can enter the area and deliver all that support desperately needed by the refugees. This is day four, and some still rely on foods that they still have on their houses. But when it reaches a week after the quake, I think things will get worse very quick if things don't improve.
The numbers of children who've died in this quake, Wayu, appears disproportionately high. Why is that?
It happens around 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So most of the children who become victims are still in schools, and their schools just collapse.
What are parents saying about the conditions at those school buildings that collapsed?
Yeah, I think we will come to a stage where we have to start asking difficult questions to school authorities and the local government on the strength of those facilities. But right now, I think the parents are still in grief and shock. They just focus on, you know, burying their loved ones.
Have you been able to speak with any of the families of people who died, or any of your reporters have spoken with them? Is there one story that stood out that maybe you can share with us?
Yeah, I think one of the main stories were about a kid who was 6 years old who was trapped for 2 days before the rescuer find him. His mom already killed in the same building, and this boy just survived because he was hiding under a big cabinet.
Wayu, I gather you are from Bogor, a few kilometers from the epicenter. How are your family and friends faring?
We are quite safe. Thank you for asking, Marco. And we were quite shocked when the quake happened. I think there's a lot of homework for Indonesian to do with disaster mitigation and anticipation, because our first instinct is not the right one. We should really hide under strong material, not just, you know, being panicked. And I think that's also contribute to the high number of victims. Mm.
Indonesia, of course, is in the so-called Ring of Fire in the Pacific, this very active geologic part of the planet. It suffered volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and as a consequence, tsunamis and floods and landslides. Do you grow up as a kid in Indonesia preparing yourself for natural disasters?
That's what I think needs to be better prepared in the future. As a kid, disaster mitigation is not really part of the school curriculum. We learn it from stories from our parents, but I think there need to be a more systematic approach to make sure that our children and us as a society can better prepare for this kind of disasters.
Wayu, in the days and weeks ahead, what are you going to be focusing your reporting on?
The 62,000 refugees will need a lot of attention, making sure that they can survive and build back their life. This is an area with 160,000 people. So 62,000 out of 162,000, meaning 30% of its population. And that will need a lot of help and support to make sure that society can, you know, get back to its feet.
Wayu Dattmika is a reporter and editor with Tempo Media Group. He was speaking with us from Jakarta about the ongoing rescue efforts following Monday's devastating earthquake centered in West Java. Wayu, thank you very much. All the best and good luck.
Thank you, Marco.
Tomorrow at Sydney's famous Bondi Beach, people will be shedding their bathing suits. An ironic gesture for a good cause, to raise awareness about skin cancer. The founder of the charity Skin Check Champions told the newspaper The Australian, "We want people to strip off and get checked, so let's strip off." The event will be photographed by American photographer Spencer Tunick. There's also some social media pressure aimed at getting Australian actor Chris Hemsworth to join in. Chris is very comfortable getting his gear off for art, Tunick said. Anyone who's seen the latest Thor trailer will know that. The strip down for skin cancer will get legal cover. Tomorrow at Bondi Beach, Section 663 of the Nude Bathing Act will be lifted for the cause. Just ahead, and for the rest of the hour, we have a special report about a war crimes prosecutor and a war criminal, the unexpected bond they developed, and why the criminal decided to turn on his former allies. Stay with us. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. As evidence of atrocities continues to surface in Ukraine, calls for war crimes tribunals are growing. But putting a former war criminal on trial at The Hague is complex, to say the least. For the rest of the hour today, we're taking a close look at one example, the ethnic cleansing and bloodshed that consumed Yugoslavia in the 1990s, and the trial of Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic. In his case, a pivotal witness was someone on the inside, someone who turned against Milosevic after the war. The World's Chris Harlan Dunaway tells the story of two men, the witness, Milan Babic, and the prosecutor, Alex Whiting. Here's Chris.
It's hard to know where to start with this long, sprawling conflict, so I'll keep it simple. Yugoslavia was a big, multi-ethnic country, but I'll only focus on two ethnic groups in this story, the Serbs and the Croats.
I'm Robert McNeil. Is Yugoslavia headed for civil war?
And in the early 90s, some of the leaders of the republics that made up Yugoslavia started fighting over whether they should go their own way. And the loudest voice was this guy.
Serbia's president, Slobodan Milosevic, had been the first to inflame his people.
Slobodan Milosevic was an ethnic Serb nationalist who saw himself as a leader of all the Serbs from all over Yugoslavia. He liked to talk about how in World War II, the Nazis committed genocide against his people. Milosevic said that could not happen again. Now that Yugoslavia was breaking apart, he warned that the Serbs needed to stand up for themselves.
In a position that we are defending ourselves, I think we are defending a right to be free and to be independent and right to live in peace.
Milosevic obsessed over the idea of a country just for Serbs, a greater Serbia. Serbs have a shared culture and history, and many of them identify with the Serbian Orthodox Church. And the church embraced Serb nationalism. In one case, religious leaders removed the remains of a Serbian war hero from the 14th century and paraded them through Serbian enclaves. The tour route matched the borders of Greater Serbia. When they were reburied, Milosevic helicoptered in and fired up the crowd.
Kada je formirana socijalistička Jugoslavija, srpski vrh je u toj novoj zemlji ostao podeljen.
One of those places Serb nationalists had their eye on was a sliver of Croatia called Krajina.
Air raid sirens wailed through the towns of eastern Croatia today as the ethnic fighting reached a new pitch.
The international community watched as the Croats and Serbs armed themselves and started clearing each other out of their homes. Something I'll be clear about from the outset. In this long and bloody conflict, atrocities were committed by all sides. By the late 1990s, US and NATO military intervention forced the Serbs to give up. But Milosevic remained in Belgrade, doing interviews, living his life. That is, until the UN Security Council set up a tribunal and indicted him for crimes against humanity. And a little later, this guy entered the picture.
I spent time in Croatia driving around, interviewing witnesses and victims.
This is Alex Whiting. He was a brand new war crimes prosecutor from America who had just joined the tribunal. The witness interviews showed him what had happened up close.
We talked to them or interviewed them in their homes, or they came to The Hague to testify. These are people who suffered, you know, tremendously. Their lives completely changed. I remember one young man who lost his entire family.
And Alex thinks he found an explanation as to why it all happened.
These ethnic conflicts don't happen because people are inherently aggressive against each other, and that the minute the lid is lifted, they go fighting at each other, and it's just ancient tensions which boil over. I think these conflicts are driven from the top.
Intercepted calls show that local Serb leaders coordinated with Milosevic in secret, and prosecutors exposed them. One of those leaders was Milan Babic.
What happened is the Milosevic indictment, very lengthy indictment, and includes names of co-conspirators. And Milan Babic's name was there.
So, how did this guy get his name listed in what might have been the biggest war crimes indictment since the Nuremberg trials against the Nazis? Here, an AP news camera catches Milan Babic. He's on his way to a municipal building for a meeting with other Serb rebel leaders. He's walking, no car, carrying a briefcase. He's heavy set, big 90s era glasses. He's wearing a brown suit, coat unbuttoned, and an orange button-down shirt underneath. Despite the loud shirt, Milan Babic looks like a bureaucrat, probably even boring. He was, but also he wasn't. Around this time, Babic was giving fiery ethnic-based speeches to thousands. He stirred fears that the Croats were coming for the Serbs. His nationalist political party partnered with the Serbian Orthodox Church to declare a referendum on whether Krajina should break away from Croatia. It passed by 99.7%. Alex Whiting, the prosecutor, thinks that number says a lot.
Of course, when you hear a number like that, you think, well, perhaps there was some manipulation of the voting. But also that the forces of fear were incredibly powerful. Babic tapped into something very deep and explosive in the Serb population in Croatia. Both tap into it and create it based in their own insecurity, their own anxiety about becoming a minority population within Croatia. So maybe it wasn't quite that high, but I've no doubt that it was pretty close.
Babic was stirring fears that the Croats were coming for the Serbs. That was then. But now, after the war, things had changed for Babic.
And I think he was living almost a kind of retired life, raising chickens. And he sees his name in the Milosevic indictment, and he becomes convinced that he's going to be indicted and that he's going to be next. And he may well have been. That may have happened. But he decided to take matters into his own hands, and he secretly approached the tribunal.
Two investigators from The Hague went to meet Babic at the Hyatt Hotel in Belgrade. When they got there, the former Serb nationalist firebrand was sitting alone, drinking coffee, sweating. It soon became clear why he wanted to meet.
His intent, his purpose, was to defend himself, because he certainly did not see himself as a war criminal.
Milan Babic agreed to cooperate.
And prosecutors knew this was a huge opportunity. Here was an insider, someone with connections to Slobodan Milosevic himself, who was ready to talk. Still ahead this hour, Milan Babic meets the prosecution. You're listening to The World. Still ahead this hour, the prosecutor, Alex Whiting, develops a complicated relationship with the war criminal, Milan Babic.
Were we friends? What was it? I prosecuted him. I played a role in him being in prison.
Plus, an unexpected outcome in Babic's story leaves a legacy for how war crimes are tried. Our story continues coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Picking up the story now, the accused Serb war criminal Milan Babic, after his snap decision to meet with prosecutors from the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, he wanted to clear his name, and as it turned out, he had quite the story to tell. The World's Chris Harlan Dunaway takes it from here.
When Babic started meeting the prosecution for interviews, it wasn't as straightforward as meeting in the Hyatt Hotel for coffee anymore. They found someplace new.
In a kind of secret location, he would travel to the location. There would be secret meetings.
That's Alex Whiting, a lawyer for the prosecution who worked on Babic's case. And as it turns out, there are videotapes of these secret meetings.
He could find other officers for the staff.
The lawyers surround Babic at the table. The walls and ceilings are dim, but the light is harsh on everyone's faces, casting shadows. He was incredibly hyperactive. He was the kind of guy who would kind of drink coffee all day and stay up all night and talk and talk and talk, and you'd ask a simple question and he would tell you, well, I need to go back 100 years and tell you this before I get to that and that, and then you have to understand this. And it was everything. What he was very caught up in all of the events, very stressed about it all, and very, very wound up.
They took me to Maksić.
I know, but who was there?
He had come in and testified without any kind of protection. He faced the genuine risk of us charging him and prosecuting him, and he would be much worse off. By meeting with prosecutors, answering their questions, Babic was taking a real gamble. But over time, they started to get to know him as a person.
You know, he was a dentist. He goes from being a dentist to entering politics.
It turned out that Milan Babic was a political animal.
One characteristic of politics in the former Yugoslavia is that there is a lot of bureaucracy and process and votes and referendums and structures and organizations and committees, and a lot that it's endless. And this is the thing that Babic just sort of loved. He like fed on, was constantly talking about these different structures and how they worked and this. He was completely embedded in that kind of thinking.
But what was most notable to the prosecution was that Babic knew everything. He was in the middle of everything. And Babic had firsthand information that held Milosevic criminally culpable. But it came with an odd irony.
In the same words that he's using to inculpate Milosevic, he's also essentially inculpating himself. Of course, that's not what he's trying to do. He's trying to create a distance, but he kind of catches himself up into the same events.
There was no talking his way out of anything. In fact, he was only talking his way in deeper. So the prosecution pitched Babic an idea. Become a witness in the trial against Slobodan Milosevic. But it came with a catch.
You also have to take responsibility. We can't just let you skate because you came in afterwards to tell the story. You can get credit, and you should get credit for providing evidence and for cooperating, but you shouldn't just walk away from any responsibility.
All rise, veuillez vous lever. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia is now in session.
There are three judges in red-fronted robes, seated at a high table up front.
Please be seated.
The prosecution and defense are at long benches. Slobodan Milosevic enters. He's surrounded by three huge guards. One holds up a microphone for him to speak into. And he doesn't have a lawyer.
Now, do you want some time to consider now whether you wish to be represented?
I consider this tribunal a false tribunal. And indictments, false indictments. It is illegal.
Now, do you want to have the indictment read out or not?
That's your problem.
This set the tone. Before long, Milosevic stops using English, and the interpreters take over. You're going to hear a lot of interpreters. Milosevic pled not guilty. With no lawyer, he would be representing himself in court, and the prosecution soon begins calling witnesses.
I remember, in particular, there's one woman that I remember who came to court and testified, and I actually led her in court. I think that she was 18 or maybe even younger when the crimes occurred. All the Croat civilians were attacked in the village, and militia came through the house and killed many of her family members, injured her. Her arm was still injured even to this day. And she came into court and testified and was cross-examined by Slobodan Milosevic. You know, we were kind of cheering for her, right? Because you were kind of afraid that she's going to get intimidated and get kind of feel pushed around. I mean, this is Slobodan Milosevic, a, you know, mythical figure who is incredibly aggressive in court and allowed to, you know, do whatever he wants for the most part. And she stood up to him, wasn't going to be pushed around by him, you know, no fear, answered the questions, and was incredibly strong. And, you know, you kind of like, wow. I mean, that's just amazing. You know, that's incredibly moving.
Testifying against Milosevic could be dangerous, too. Witnesses were threatened. So some testify behind a shield of anonymity. One is a witness codenamed C-61. C-61 was a prominent politician in Croatia.
And when you watch the broadcast, you just see a blurry image and a voice, a distorted voice.
This is to protect his identity, of course. You can barely make out a human form in the footage. It's all oversized pixels with some flesh-colored ones where you might expect someone's face to be. And this witness knows a lot. And Milosevic presses them hard through an interpreter, of course.
But anyway, tell me this. Is this part of the report in keeping...
Milosevic starts accusing C-61 of sabotaging peace in Croatia. And here's what C-61 has to say, through an interpreter, of course. But by this point, it's becoming more and more obvious who this witness really is.
As far as I know, Babic did endeavor to remain in the realm of politics.
He spoke about himself in the third person, right?
C-61 was, of course, Milan Babic, Milosevic's former ally and nationalist leader of Krajina, the breakaway region for Serbs in Croatia.
That was the problem with him being a protected witness, is that he was such a significant figure that you couldn't talk about these events without talking about him. The newspapers and media in the region started saying, well, this has to be Milan Babic because there's nobody else who would know this kind of information.
So you see the whole trial differently. Even though a lot of the trial takes place in private session, where witnesses like Babic give testimony in secret, once you know, you can't unknow that C-61 is Babic. Before you see Milosevic sitting, almost looking bored, half slumped, arm dangling over the back of his chair, grilling this guy whose face is pixelated. But once you know it's Babic, you wonder, is that bored look actually resignation? Because the testimony is so damning? In any case, what becomes clear is that you're watching a bitter duel play out in real time. Here's Milosevic again.
Question. Well, is it disputed that Professor Jovan Rašković was a very well-known, very competent, and very famous psychiatrist?
And here's Babic.
Answer. As far as I know, he was well-respected as a doctor and academician.
And now Milosevic goes for the jugular.
Question. Precisely. And is it true that he emphasized having noticed in you a schizophrenic, narcissoid tendency?
The judge jumps in and cuts him off.
It is not a proper question, any way, shape, or form. It's merely a comment and sounds like a pretty cheap one at that. Yes. Next.
That was a kind of constant thing that was going on through the trial. Milosevic would ask questions like that that were provocative, personal, insulting, beside the point, irrelevant, and all of this was wasting time and distraction.
And if you're wondering what happened in those private sessions, Alex gave me the tapes of those. When you combine the secret and public testimony, you start to notice something happening with C-61, aka Milan Babic. When Milosevic presses him on his past actions, Babic spends a minute or so talking about referendums and polling he did. Then he says this. Remember, this is the voice of the interpreter.
I believe that I did get support of the public opinion and the voters in Kraina for my positions, and I do not think that these were extremist positions. In retrospect, I think it was ethno-egotistic, and that is why I would certainly not advocate the policy that you drew us into, and that is a policy of national divisions, separatism, rifts, and inter-ethnic conflicts.
There was always this sort of tension between, on the one hand, accepting responsibility, on the other hand, defending himself. And then the second thing is this kind of endless and exhausting reliance on kind of legalisms. I went through the proper channels. That was a sort of maddening defense to all that had happened. It was like you would kind of, rather than step back and see the bigger picture of what was actually going on, you kind of descend into all of this legalese, bureaucratic, procedural language that would kind of deaden and mask and hide and obfuscate all that had really occurred. And so he was always struggling with that.
But as Milosevic presses Babic again and again, the struggle forces Babic to make a choice. Like this moment, when Milosevic is cross-examining him.
You are saying things diametrically opposite to the things that you were telling us when we were discussing issues of peace and war.
And this is where the transformation inside Milan Babic is revealed for all to see.
Answer, I repent for having become an ethno-egotist. That's true. I am sorry that I was an egotist at the time. I'm sorry because I am now fully convinced that it was the primary cause for all the things that eventually happened. It was horrible.
Even though there were times that he kind of defended himself or distanced himself, and even there he's kind of blaming Milosevic for, well, you led me into this, he's still taking responsibility and repenting and using, you know, kind of religious language, right, and ideas about confession and repentance and responsibility.
Two days later, Babic does something no one expected. His defense lawyer stands up and tells the judges that Babic is taking a whole different leap of faith.
My client asks you to lift the order of non-disclosure in this case. He wants to go public.
You're watching the screen and the judges say, okay, we're lifting the protective measures. And then it's out, and then there he is. He appears, and it's kind of like from behind the screen.
But by this point, his anonymity as C61 is actually holding him back.
Once you go public, then you're kind of crossing over, or let's say you're recognizing or accepting that you have crossed over. There's no going back anymore. He was able to see through his own rationalizations, to understand that even though he had believed in what he was doing, he had ended up committing crimes.
Earlier, when Milosevic was cross-examining C61, Milan Babic would try to explain himself using deadening bureaucratic jargon. But now he starts owning his role. He says he repents and that he's sorry.
You hear the echoes of what he's going to say when he pleads guilty.
I watch a video of the plea with Alex. Babic rises, wearing a black suit, and he starts his plea. Here are his words through the voice of the interpreter.
I come before this tribunal with a deep sense of shame and remorse. I have allowed myself to take part in the worst kind of persecution of people simply because they were Croats and not Serbs. Innocent people were persecuted, innocent people were evicted forcibly from their houses, and innocent people were killed. Even after I learned what had happened, I kept silent. I have asked help from God to make it easier for me to repent, and I am thankful to God for making it possible for me to express my repentance. I ask from my brothers Croats, to forgive us, their brother Serbs.
And lastly, I place myself at the full disposal of this tribunal and the international judge.
Moving. It's just overwhelming. Yeah. I mean, that's such an important statement, which took so much courage and strength, and it was such an example and such an important moment in the tribunal. Doing these cases and trying to get justice in these cases is incredibly hard and stressful and exhausting, and it's just an endless battle and fight. To have a moment like this where somebody comes in and says, well, you know what, this is how it was, and this is what happened, and I take responsibility for it. Just like, okay, finally, you know, finally, like, that's what we're fighting for. The pretending, the lying, the obfuscation is ended. Here is a moment, a rare moment, where somebody's coming in and saying, yeah, it happened, and I was responsible, and I played a part in it.
Babic was sentenced to 13 years in prison. And that began a new chapter for him personally, maybe his most important one, and for reasons no one expected, his most lasting one.
In the final part of our story set at the International Tribunal in The Hague, American prosecutor Alex Whiting needed Serbian war criminal Milan Babic to keep cooperating. What he did not expect was just how much their relationship would change. Once again, here's Chris Harlan Dunaway.
At first, Milan Babic was held in the UN detention unit at The Hague.
He was transformed as a person. He was no longer frenetic and caught up in all these little stories and details and intrigues and complexities. I know you have to go back 20 years to understand this, and you have to understand this committee. And he was calm, relaxed, much more clear, much more direct.
And the religious language, like Babic used in his guilty plea, repentance, forgiveness, this stuff was more than just words.
He had kind of returned to religion. He was, even with other inmates, talking about the Bible and reading the Bible with them. And I think it was a shared thing in his environment.
And he used it to grapple with his crimes.
And that's part of the reason why I was also relieved that he was willing to do it again, because I knew it was hard. He continued to testify.
During these weeks of preparation for other cases, Alex and Babic would spend hours together.
And, you know, when we were in the detention unit preparing his testimony, we would ask each other about our families and how he was, and kind of sometimes laugh together, or make jokes, and, you know, relax. It was very, very human connection.
On the first day of Babic's court testimony against another Serb war criminal, he reads a typed statement expressing his own role in the atrocities that took place in Croatia. Then Alex questions Babic for 3 straight days.
Mr. Babic, I asked you with respect to some of the transcripts, but I neglected this.
But something didn't feel right.
What did he do? Like he has talked a lot about what everyone else did and how it was their fault and they were responsible. But he has, in doing so, in telling that, he's kind of left himself out of the story.
Alex leans against the bench in his prosecutor's outfit, a black robe and white bib, with Babic across the courtroom.
What did you plead guilty to? What do you take responsibility for?
And you see a moment where I think he completely understands why I'm asking that question.
In 1991,
I succumbed to the passions of politics and ethnical egotism.
Babic finishes, and he's taken back to the UN detention unit, while Alex mulls over Babic's answer.
I remember thinking, okay, like, I wish you'd gone a little further than that, but that's okay, you did fine.
What's the significance of that question, the other significance of that question?
It's the last question. the last question I asked him. And then, you know, killed himself.
Alex was at home with his family when the deputy prosecutor called him with the news.
So I remember going into the hallway and sitting on the stairs, and he told me that he had killed himself. And, you know, I just started sobbing. You know, and I'm right now just telling it. And, you know, I was at that moment, you know, struck by how strange it was. And this is why I keep returning to this story and thinking about it and talking about it, is how strange it was that I was so strongly affected, you know, devastated by the suicide of a war criminal.
At the UN Detention Center in The Hague that night, a guard checked on Babic. He waved and all seemed well. A half hour later, a guard checked again, but it was too late. Dutch authorities and a judge from the tribunal both investigated Babic's suicide and discovered no foul play.
I had come to The Hague to prosecute people like Milan Babic. But here I was affected in a way that was different. I had a different relationship to him. And there's really no word for that. I don't know what to call it. You know? I don't know what that relationship was. Were we friends? Were we colleagues? Were we acquaintances? Were we worked together? What was it? I prosecuted him. I was sitting in court when he pled guilty. I worked out the guilty plea. I insisted on him pleading guilty. I thought it was important. It was something we pushed for. I played a role in him being in prison. All of us talked about it and scrutinized why. You know, the only note he left was to his wife, which...
Babic tucked a note inside his Bible in his cell. I pull out a copy and start to hand it to Alex, but he stops me.
You have to read it.
Says, "My beloved, find peace for yourself and don't mourn me. I need peace. Your Milan, Sunday, 5th of March, 2006. Let the God forgive."
Yeah. So, you know, that's the only indication from him about why, what was in, going through his mind at the time.
Alex has examined his own role in Babic's suicide. He doesn't feel remorse for prosecuting the war criminal. Mostly, he focuses on Babic's decision to take responsibility by testifying, to do the right thing in the end. But his feelings towards Babic are complicated.
Would you call him a friend?
I can't think of a better word.
So in the absence of the right word, Alex got to know Babic, laughed with him, they talked about politics, family, religion. The two worked together towards justice. And without hesitation, Alex put Babic in prison. Friend isn't the right word, but until there is a word for the kind of relationship Alex Whiting, the prosecutor, had with Milan Babic, the war criminal, it's the only word that comes close. Babic never saw the verdict in Slobodan Milosevic's case. Neither did anyone else. 6 days after Babic killed himself, Milosevic died of a heart attack in detention. The trial was brought to a close. There was no ruling. For The World, I'm Chris Harlan Dunaway.
After Milan Babic's death, the testimony he provided ultimately helped convict at least four other Serbian war criminals, including Milosevic's spy chief, who was convicted of crimes against humanity. Prosecutor Alex Whiting is now teaching at Harvard Law School. Funding for this story was provided by the Henry Luce Foundation. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend. And as always, thank you for listening.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.